Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Fresh from the Hill, Inside Stories of Noteworthy Cornellians. I'm your host, Camila Salazar, class of 2016. Today, I'm sitting down with Sydney Mann, a 2018 graduate who majored in American Studies with a focus in media and society and a minor in English. Welcome to the show, Sydney.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. So I like to start all of my interviews off with kind of getting to know a little bit more about you and your life at Cornell.
Okay.
So tell me about it. You know, did you have any favorite groups, activities, favorite library?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And I feel like I haven't thought about that in a while. Well, about me, I was involved in Cornell's all-female a cappella group, Nothing But Trouble, for all 4 years, which was one of my favorite things. It really like provided a community for me on campus. I was also a facilitator for Cornell's Intergroup Dialogue Project, which I did for 3 years, which I also loved. I loved the people at Cornell. And in terms of favorite study spot, I would have to say Catherine Library, actually. For an arts and sciences student, that's like a weird answer, but it was the most calming library, and it was in the middle of everything for me, so it was really nice. But I did like Mann Library and Mandibles, and I'm sad Mandibles is going away.
It is? I didn't even know this. I'm sorry.
I think so. Yeah, I saw on Instagram that it's just like going away, and it is what it is.
Sad. I was always upset that they didn't take Cornell Card.
I know. I was there all the time, and like Cornell Card was the best, especially at Statler when you can just Cornell Card at Regent. So like, I haven't thought about these things in a while.
I know, but it's so dangerous. I feel like every single time I go back to visit, which it's been a while now, you know, pandemic, but every single time you just, I mean, you always have to stop by Regent, but it's almost not the same when you can't Cornell Card it.
It's not the same.
Not the same.
It's not, because after a cappella practice, a lot of the girls and I would stop at Regent, and it felt easier and nicer when you could just Cornell Card it, and it was special.
Yeah.
It was a special thing to do. And I went back, I think 3 years ago, like right before the pandemic, and I stopped by there.
So tell me more about your involvement with Nothing But Trouble. I loved a cappella in general. I was not in any group because I unfortunately cannot sing. But did you have a favorite song, favorite performance, like stand out? Like, tell me about your favorite parts of being in this a cappella group.
Yeah. So I actually found out about NBT because my sister was in the group. So she was a senior when I was a freshman. So I auditioned, I got in. My favorite part about it was just I joined before I could do any Greek life. So I really made a lot of friends from there. One of my best friends is in my voice part. I was in alto too. Some of the favorite songs we did, I got into arranging music while I was at school. I did not know how to do it before. I was really lucky that I had people older than me that were willing to teach me. So a lot of the songs that I liked that we did, I didn't sing. We did Somebody to Love. I arranged that my senior year for my good friend Gina. And it was just very special. It was one of those things where it's your last concert. I did this for a friend, and it was such a nice moment. That was my favorite thing. And I beatboxed too. So any song I beatboxed, I liked a lot.
Okay, the beatboxing, extremely cool. For in terms of arranging, for someone who is not familiar with, you know, a cappella or the ins and outs of music, what, like, can you explain what arranging a song entails?
Yeah, so I played piano growing up, and I did a lot of musical theater. So a lot of it is just, there's this app or website we use called NoteFlight. So it's really about, like, building voice parts on the sheet music. So if you've ever seen piano sheet music, it's very similar. You split it up into alto two, alto one, soprano two, soprano one. And starting off with the bass line, the way I do it is I listen to the song and then I find the beat. And for me, at least, I like listening to the song and I'm like, oh, okay, what would be a fun part to sing in the background? And like, what would I want to sing? So that's usually how I go about it. And then I have to edit it to make it like musically correct, which always is the most difficult part. And then I look up stuff on YouTube for inspiration and stuff like that. And obviously people in my group helped me too. So it's a lot about reading music, but it's also being able to hear the music, I think too.
Yeah. So how have you carried, if at all, music into your present day life today? You know, you've been, you graduated about 3 years ago. Tell me.
At Cornell, I never actually took creative writing, but I always wanted to. It never fit into my schedule, but I'd always write by myself. I took screenwriting. I minored in English. I really have loved reading and writing. So throughout my time at Cornell, I was always writing. And then after school, I realized, wow, like I'm finally an adult where there's no singing anymore. There's no group. There's no choir. I mean, there are in the city. So I started actually writing songs by myself. And I think I've written like 11. And then I say to my friends, like, I'm working on a musical, but I am working on a musical now. And it has to do with a lot of the reasons why I've actually gotten into the work I'm doing right now with From Privilege to Progress, and a lot about the experiences that have come to form my identity. Mm-hmm. And
Well, I mean, amazing transition. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the work you're doing right now? This is an internship you have with From Privilege to Progress. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about the organization and your role with them right now?
Yeah. So the organization started in 2018 when Melissa DiPino, she's a white woman, she taped two men getting arrested at a Starbucks in Philadelphia. And this other woman, she's black, Michelle Son, was there. And Michelle Son was calling attention to how this was bad, this was happening. So Melissa picked up her phone and took a video, and it went viral. So the whole idea there is when you have a white person uplifting, like a person of color, somebody who's marginalized, more white people are going to listen. It's one of the forms of allyship. So from there, they created From Privilege to Progress, which is a national movement to desegregate conversations about race online. I mean, I thought that I was putting in the anti-racism work at school. I mentioned I was involved in the Intergroup Dialogue Project, which is a wonderful program. It's really centered around how you communicate across differences in identity. But in 2018, and especially this past summer, when there was a lot going on with Black Lives Matter and everybody was posting on social media, I realized that like 90% of my feed was still white. Not following diverse activists and stuff and really hearing everything in own voices. So that's when I started really following them, and they posted about an internship opportunity, and I happened to be unemployed. I'm going to school in the fall. And I was like, oh, this looks cool. I'll apply. I sent in a video. And the reason why I applied was because even with this musical work I'm doing and what I want to do at school, I just really would love to uplift, marginalized histories, the ones that we typically don't learn in school. Mm-hmm. And what I'm doing with them now is that I'm managing their social media. I mean, they manage their Instagram, but I've been helping a lot with who they should be speaking to for lives. I've been helping design graphics, helping them just brainstorm in general in terms of how they can target a younger audience, especially in this oversaturated social media field. So it's been really great, and it's been a huge learning experience, and I'm really grateful.
So you've mentioned now a couple of times your work at Cornell with the Intergroup Dialogue Project. I would love to hear more about your experience with it. I remember wanting to take that in college and never really fitting in my schedule. And I know some people, you know, they took it once and it really, really opened their eyes to a lot of things, but some people fall in love with it and they do it, and then they become facilitators and they facilitate these conversations for the next, you know, few semesters of college. And I would love to hear a little bit about your, it sounds like you had a really great experience with it. You did it for several years, not just one semester. So I'd love to hear your experience with it and how that kind of helped you in the moment and how it's kind of like shaped, who you are now.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I got involved in IDP as a student. I think it was the end of my freshman year or sophomore year, I want to say. Yeah, that makes more sense because my facilitator was a freshman while I was a sophomore. I took a course in socioeconomic status. I was actually looking to take the course kind of as like my own safe space. I wrote this in my P2P post, introduction post, and I don't really mind sharing it here, but I was assaulted my freshman year at Cornell, and I didn't really like know at the time what that meant, right? Like something happened. It was hard to talk about with people. My sister had taken IDP and she was in a gender course. So I was like, okay, cool. Like maybe they'll place me here, therapy. But it turned out I got placed in socioeconomic status, and the way they structure the course is half the people have agency, half the people are marginalized. I happen to be in the group with agency. And sitting through the course, even thinking about race in this course, it just really opened my eyes that, like, you know, there are ways that I feel oppressed, but there are so many more ways that I have privilege, and I could utilize that to help other people feel empowered, because I felt so low and silenced that really pushed me to challenge myself and challenge the ways that I do have privilege. So it was a great experience for me. And I know it is for other people, because they do find it to be cathartic. But for somebody like me, it was, how can I learn more? How can I do better? And how can I kind of use this towards a career in media, how to uplift marginalized voices in media? So after that course, I was nominated to become a facilitator, and I facilitated 2 race dialogues, 1 in nationality, and I think 1 in socioeconomic status. I wound up being invited to come back after I graduated. So after I graduated, I still facilitated with them for a semester, as well as worked on their PR. So the way that that's kind of come into my current position with Privilege to Progress is just, again, like, how can we use our privilege as white women to take a step back and give space for other people? Like, how can we use those tools? So that's what I've been working on.
Yeah, you mentioned that you thought you were doing the work, the anti-racist work at Cornell, which clearly you were, you know, not denying that, but, you know, the wording you use, you know, I thought I was, and then, you know, these things happened, mm-hmm. last summer happened. What is it that you think was missing from your active work back then that you're incorporating into your day-to-day now?
Yeah. So in IDP, we definitely talk about spheres of influence. And I was trying to, you know, talk to friends and family whenever I could, call them in as opposed to call them out. I really love reading about pop culture and social issues, and especially when I feel like the narrative's not including something. Like, historically, I go full on nerd and I will delve into it, and I like writing about this stuff. And, you know, I was reading, I was doing everything. But once I left Cornell, I wound up being in a very homogenous space still, like a very white space. And I'm sure people like me find that. Because actually at Cornell, though, before I entered IDP, I was still in very homogenous spaces. So I didn't realize that while I thought I was doing the work still, there are things that I totally forgot, like how we're socialized in the media into like our whiteness and our identity, or how we think about other people and stories. So when I started to see other people post from activists that I hadn't seen before, I would follow literally every single person that I learned something from. And from Privilege to Progress too, I found a lot of people to follow. So the work that I wasn't doing was like my screen time work, which was the most important work you could be doing during quarantine.
Yeah.
And then there are other things too. I was on a live with From Privilege to Progress, and there's little time to prepare. And as a white woman, I know I can take up a lot of space in conversations. So one thing I still try to do all the time is to make space for other people. Whether that's a corporate job when I was working at HarperCollins, or if it's in the work I do now. So it's constant reminders to myself, like, how can I incorporate this into my family life, my work life, but also like myself and like the things I'm consuming on a daily basis. So if that answers your question, I never realized that that's what my newsfeed was and how that was impacting how I was thinking about things, specifically on Instagram.
Always goes back to Instagram.
Yeah.
So you also mentioned recently, and I think earlier as well, that you also worked at HarperCollins. Is that correct? Can you tell me a little bit about your time there and kind of like your trajectory from like Cornell to there, and also from there now? I think you also mentioned that you're going to grad school. So I guess kind of like the whole trajectory of where you've come from since you left Cornell 3 years ago.
Yeah. So I graduated Cornell, and I think as an art student, it's such a hard thing sometimes, because you're seeing people your senior year get a lot of jobs in like finance, they're guaranteed that job. And personally, I always knew I was going to be in a position where I was going to be applying to jobs second semester. Mm-hmm. And I took advantage of Cornell, I think more than more people I know. Mm-hmm. Cornell Arts and Sciences has a wonderful careers center, and I advocate for them so much because after I graduated, I actually had a job and I quit the job after 3 months because it was just like, I studied history and American studies and it just wasn't what I wanted to do. I took a job way too quickly out of pressure. So I was lucky that the Intergroup Dialogue Project was like, we have a job, come here. Mm-hmm. And I took advantage of Cornell's resources as an alumni. I spoke with the alumni office. They pointed me to Cornell CU eLinks, if you know what that is.
Yeah.
It's like LinkedIn for Cornell. And on there, you can connect with any alumni. So I met an editor from HarperCollins through there, Rosemary Brosnan. I love her. She's amazing. She invited me into the office. We had a conversation. I was really looking to get into storytelling. And I thought children's literature was perfect because that's how kids' minds grow through reading. And they have a really great diverse portfolio. So after that conversation, she showed me this job in advertising and I applied. I didn't really know what it would be. I also had the expectation that I'd work like there for 2 years doing advertising and I really wanted to pivot into editorial. And my experiences there were great. I definitely learned how to be a very organized worker. The people there were lovely. And then once the pandemic set in, working at home is really hard, especially mm-hmm. at a desk job. And I realized that the thing I was doing at IDP, I was helping them there too. They have a podcast now. I was helping them figure out like, how can we tell the story of IDP to Cornell's campus? Like, how do we do that online? So I was always very interested in media. When the pandemic was going on, I kept on thinking about those things. And I was like, I really want to write. I really want to help other people tell their story. Advertising is wonderful. But that led me to apply to Columbia's oral history program. Mm-hmm. And what oral history is, it's just how do you preserve histories in people's own voices. And so primary source building, archiving, videotaping, docuseries work. And I was like, this is cool. Like, I didn't know this existed. Yeah. And I applied on a whim. I got in and I'm hoping to still work in the media space, but with interviewing people and understanding like, how can I create or help somebody else create a product that tells a story that has been told before, but maybe people haven't listened to.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you might be a great candidate for the next host of this podcast. We'll see. Stay tuned, listeners. I personally think you'd make a great candidate.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's very sweet.
You're welcome. So it sounds like you left HarperCollins and now you're starting on an exciting new journey very soon.
Yes.
At Columbia. Congratulations again.
Thank you.
In the interim, we're circling back to you're interning at From Privilege to Progress. I would love to hear from your perspective. Well, one, I think it's so refreshing to hear, you know, a white woman be very self-aware of their white womanness. And I would love to hear if you have any like stories or examples of times when you kind of felt caught out or like you felt that those moments of cognitive dissonance when you're like, oh, wait a minute, I'm doing that thing. Cause I feel like those are mm-hmm. those are the moments when you learn also.
Yeah, totally. I think when people call me in, like throughout IDP, like every mentor I had, and I love them and I appreciate that they really worked with me because like I said, white women take up a lot of space in conversations and part of having privilege is feeling like you could speak on any issue, right? And I love school. I'm a nerd. So I tended to intellectualize a lot of things as opposed to speaking from personal experiences, which is what you're asking me to do. So that was one of the things. Another thing that comes to mind is when I started IDP, my facilitator, Alexis, and I got into a conversation and she's a young Black woman. She's amazing. She's getting her PhD at Stanford. And she was a year younger than me. So this conversation really like shook me a little. I brought up the term check your privilege. I was a sophomore. I like didn't really understand. And I was like, I find that like offensive. And she was like, why? And we got into this conversation. And at the end of it, I was just like, thank you for having this conversation with me and educating me. Like, you did not have to do that. Like, I don't know how you did this without like getting angry. She probably was, but that was actually the first moment where like I woke up a little and like IDP started to change my mind. And I think a good thing to bring up would actually be like doing IDP like while doing school and like taking courses with diverse professors. I took this wonderful course called Southern Horrors, and it was basically just history of the South. It was with Martha Washington. It was my senior year. It was like 8 people in a room. And I kind of expected everybody to take that course wanting to learn about like Black history and history of Reconstruction. I expected actually there to be like progressive people in the room. And it was like a mix of people that I didn't know existed at Cornell. And a lot of them I probably would encounter in IDP, somebody whose views are completely like this way of me. And I came into the course being like, yeah, like I know this stuff, like I'm woke, whatever. And I decided to write a final paper. And this is the one I submitted to Columbia on anti-lynching politics and sexual assault and how Black women were the purveyors of just getting these anti-lynching movements on the table, how white women contributed to falsely accusing Black men of sexual assault. Like that's really what I focused on. And I focused on Ida B. Wells and Mary Church Terrell's rhetoric and how they got that across. And I sat with my teacher, Martha. I doubt she remembers this, but I was saying like how I wanted my essay to be. I was saying, yeah, I want to say like one's conforming to respectability politics and the other's really trying to push the limit. And she looked at me and she was like, you're a white woman writing this paper. Like I'd be very careful in terms of criticism and harshness, because we tend to do that in academic papers, regardless when we're thinking about figures in the past. So just really think about your race. And I did, I wrote the paper. And while I was reading the paper, I kept on like writing sentences. And I was like, wait a minute, hold up. Like, this should be like a celebration. This should be uplifting. This is not my opinion to assert here. Mm-hmm. So I really changed the paper, and I quoted a lot of other people. And at the end, my conclusion was like, these are the things I actually learned about like how we write about history. Mm-hmm. So that was like a real moment for me where I was like, as a white person who wants to go into history, it's really important to know like how I write about these things and like how I'm thinking about my whiteness in regards to like how I'm analyzing Black literature, Black voices. So when I returned to that essay this past year for Columbia, I think I actually found the draft of it. I didn't find the final. So I was reading through it and I was just like, what am I saying? Like, I know so much more now than I did then. And I rewrote the whole thing. It was like a 15-page paper. And I was just like very passionate about like, here are the things I've learned since then. But like my professor's words just like stuck in my head for a very long time. And I'm really appreciative that she took the moment to say that to me.
Yeah. Do you have any like tips or advice, like concrete or tangible things that you can tell people, other, you know, white people or maybe more people in more privileged positions who are writing about, you know, historical, like exactly what you did, like historical context or historical things where they are coming at it from a position of privilege and power of like ways so that they can actively check themselves as they're writing or like ways to reevaluate their thinking as they're writing?
Yeah. That's something I actually think about a lot. Like that's why sometimes like, in like my adult life, I can say, I have been meaning to like start a blog and really write about the things I want to write about, but I've been very careful and very strategic almost, because I don't want to write on things that don't have anything to do with me. You know, like when it is an issue that my voice doesn't need to be in, I'd rather amplify it. So I started taking a master class with Roxane Gay about social justice writing. And a lot of the things she talks about is like, and it's what Toni Morrison says, like, if you have a story, like tell your story. And she talks a lot about like if your personal experience ties into the issue you're talking about, like speak from that personal experience. I think about it a lot when I write. It's like, okay, if a white person wanted to write about like police brutality, like the first thing I would say, and this is like what we did in IDP, like what are my experiences with the police? And like, how can I write about like, I think of cops differently because I've been conditioned to think of them differently based on my personal interactions, and then uplift from other sources being like, well, this isn't happening. So I guess my advice would be like, really write about yourself and be uncomfortable. Like, just like the question you asked me, like, what are your experiences as a white woman? Like, I think that's really important when white people want to talk about these things. It's like, challenge yourself and how do you actually apply to the issue rather than intellectualizing it and making it something just like to chat about. And I'm still learning how to do that, but she's very helpful in just framing like, how do you tie in your identity to what you're writing? And that's also what I'm hoping to learn in my master's program. So I think it's also constantly about like researching too, like Roxane Gay is like, if you are writing something and you don't have the proper research to back it up, you may as well not be writing about it. So drawing from as many sources as possible and just like doing your homework.
Yeah. I love that. Roxane Gay, all the things that we've spoken about up till now in terms of, you know, what you did at Cornell and what, you know, your foray into HarperCollins and now your grad program that you're going to start. Yeah. It's very clear you want to be a storyteller. Can you tell me some of your like dreams and ambitions? Like, what are the types of stories you want to tell? Like, are, you know, what kind of work do you want to be doing? Is there a specific story that comes to mind that you want to be able to help tell one day?
Yeah. And those are the things I talk about because a lot of the people, or think about, because a lot of the people in my program are coming in and they know. So the thesis project has to be like, it doesn't have to be a written thesis. It can be a project. And a lot of the people already know what they want to focus on. I know very generally the things that I want to talk about and focus on the themes, but specific stories, I don't know yet because I really want to talk to people on the ground, like specifically in New York. And I actually like to talk to like Black women and white women and really confront white feminism is like what I would like to do. But some of the things I focused on at school were historical erasure and historical trauma. I read, I'm bringing her up again, but a lot of Toni Morrison, and I kind of made sense of my own assault through understanding how narratives around sexual assault for Black women have been erased. And like, that's one of the things I'd like to focus on, like how events in our history have been erased and how we can recover those voices. So I would really like to incorporate that into like news storytelling. Just like From Privilege to Progress talks about how, you know, if you're white, your social media feed's going to be 90% white. I realized this past summer, and this is actually one of the things I wrote about when I first started IDP. I was like, I'd love to use these skills to like, and not become a journalist per se, but how do you integrate this type of work into new storytelling and media, something that frames our opinion on so many things in like a really white space? So my ultimate dream would be like, how do you create like a news media company that's just entirely own voices from own experiences that tie into the current events we're seeing? Because even watching the Olympics last night, and it's, you know, it matters. There are two white male commentators. And I'm just like, what if there were somebody who were Black or Latinx just there and to give their commentary too, because there are so many social issues revolving the Olympics right now. So it's how do we get people in one place to tell those stories and have that platform? So I'm hoping to like use my privilege in order to create a platform like that, like figure that sphere out a little bit more. And that's why I really like new media that's focused on like empathy and storytelling.
I think empathy is absolutely key. I talk about empathy nonstop every day in my personal and professional lives. So I love that you just emphasize that right there. I think the last question that I have for you is, you know, we've been talking so much about what doing the work actually looks like, what it looked like for you specifically. Of course, you're the guest here, so what it looked like for you specifically. And I would love, you know, your maybe advice or opinions on how other people who might want to take this journey, but they don't know where to start, like where some resources maybe for other people who come from more privileged backgrounds where they can start learning about, you know, checking their privilege or like kind of understanding the way that they walk in the world and like how to help them with their like personal anti-racism journeys.
Yeah, that is a great question. And it's something still, I feel like it's an everyday thing, right? Like, I feel like once I graduated from school and I left IDP, I had to be like a lot more cognizant of the things that I've learned, because it's really easy to forget as a white person, because part of having privilege is like, oh, you forget about these things. But when I first started, it was really helpful. Actually, like I listened to NPR a lot just because I feel like their coverage is all encompassing and it includes like identity within it. There are some great podcasts to listen to. I don't know them off the top of my head, but where I started was my coursework at school. Like I read the autobiography of Malcolm X and it was just thinking through like, how did I learn this growing up in school? And like, what are the words I'm reading now? And like, how am I seeing this history now for what it is? And starting with books like White Fragility is great, but like journaling about like how you feel about these things that are being talked about. Like if you're trying to start your anti-racism journey and you feel yourself getting offended by something said in the media about like marginalized people, like, or like confronting your whiteness, like the one thing that has always helped me has been journaling. Why do I feel this way? Like, what are my personal experiences? Like really centering it on myself. Like you can read a lot and you could read articles, and I push people to read articles that about topics they're interested in, but then also find articles that challenge those topics. Something for me, I think about is like television and how in Mayor of Easttown, it's a great show, but it's extremely white. And there's a lot of erasure when it comes to redlining in that show. So it's really about understanding yourself first and your identity first before you can try to understand others, and like building that capacity to perspective take and empathize. So I love books by Toni Morrison, I said, Roxane Gay, Ibram X. Kendi. And I would also like, this is a plug, but I'd follow like From Privilege to Progress on Instagram or like Check Your Privilege, because a lot of the articles or websites given there confront whiteness. So it's also, and I should have said this before, it's also like suspending your own judgment. Like you have to be okay with like being offended. And if you feel guilty in any way, it's like, okay, well, why do you feel guilty? Like, how is this productive? And I felt guilty plenty this past year. And then I have to sit down and I'm just like, there are things that are written about this that can help me understand. But personally, why do I feel guilt or shame? So I always like to just bring it back to the first perspective.
I honestly love that. I think something that I, you know, in the wake of, you know, George Floyd's murder last summer and, you know, the resurgence of Black Lives Matter and but also not just a resurgence, but just the sheer volume of people who are finally getting involved in the conversation for the first time, and not, you know, when it came up with Trayvon Martin or Ferguson or, you know, so see it, so many, it's been on so many people's radars for so long, but to see the scope now this time, you know, people don't know how to process. And sometimes in the era that we live in now, people tend to process in public. And I think that there's something very valid about like the feelings that you feel and your knee-jerk reactions, and we need to process those. And I think it's so key that like you don't have to process things in public. You know, like you can journal about why you're offended by these things and why you're feeling some kind of way when you're a white person or a more privileged person. And like you can work through that on your own. Like you can feel your feelings, feel valid, work through them, understand where they come from. And then at the end, no one's, you know, you don't look like an entitled person on the internet. So I think that is like the best advice.
Yeah. Well, but with that too, and like in IDP, we talk about like modeling vulnerability. Like I really try to push myself to like be very uncomfortable, especially on social media. Mm-hmm. So this past summer, and you brought up Ferguson and everything, and I was at school when that was all happening. And I remember seeing that. And I remember being like almost upset when George Floyd and everything happened, but when a lot of people were like, I'm shocked, like, why is this happening? And I was like, this just happened, like, mm-hmm. in 2016. Like, that's why social media is important, yeah. right? And that's why like media in itself is really important to get people talking about these things. And you just said it, like, people don't know how to talk about these things.
Yeah.
So something I've tried to do on my Instagram, like quite a few times, is like, write it from my perspective and just saying like, hey, like, this is how I may have messed up in the past, or this is like a preconceived notion I had, and this is what helped me. Here are some resources. And I've had people reach out to me being like, that's helpful. I keep mindful not to like center myself in the conversation. That is something I am really, really cognizant of. But something I try to do, and I want to try to do more of, is like, how can I show somebody else like how to engage in discomfort and like really push themselves?
Yeah.
And if I do it, maybe somebody else will start to like model it that way.
Yeah. And I think that's key. I mean, I think the modeling vulnerability, that's truly key. And I think it's slightly different than the, you know, journaling out loud or journaling in public, you know, because this is like a more processed thing. And this is you kind of trying to put yourself as an example for other people to follow. Yeah. I think it reminds me of, you know, like Chelsea Handler, who does, you know, what was it called? She did something about, basically about, it was a special that like confronted her own white privilege. And I remember, it's fun you mentioned Roxane Gay. I actually used to work for her and I used to produce her podcast.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, a year or two ago. And Chelsea Handler was a guest on our show, and we named it like Problematic Faves. And it was an okay conversation, but I think one thing that they discussed in the episode after they interviewed her was kind of how, like, objectively, this work is probably good and positive for the intended audience, you know, white women or people more privileged people. You know, there are people, Chelsea Handler is a white woman, a familiar face, a safe space to, like, kind of take a step into being vulnerable and things like that. So probably net good. But, like, you don't have to come plug yourself on a Black feminist podcast. Like, you don't need to prove yourself. Yeah. This is not for us. Watching this is probably going to annoy us. And they brought up some points of things that they thought were, like, kind of whack, you know, in the published piece or in the finished product that she put out. So, which I think is very interesting. It kind of reminds me a little bit of what you're saying, is like the people that you're intending these posts to go to reach, you're reaching them and it's doing a positive thing.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of moving forward. It's seeing, you know, the bigger reach you have, or which, like, if your audience is a slightly different one, you know, like how, like learning how to communicate with them as well.
No, it's like, it's kind of like so this is something I also think about. It's like, Privilege to Progress like taught me that most of my like newsfeed was white. But then on the flip side, most people who follow me are of my demographic, like white women. So like, you know, I've learned that like, you can't speak for other people. You can't speak for other voices. Like that just annoys them and it's not really doing the work. So like, I have spent time trying to like understand, okay, like what audience am I speaking to? And that's what Privilege to Progress does. They like understand that there are white people following them and, you know, maybe people will listen to me more on my own feed if they like know me or they identify with me as a white girl. So, and it does like stir up conversations between me and my friends, but that's exactly what it is. It's like understanding too, like who will be listening to and who you want to listen to. Like you brought up a perfect point about how, white women often go on like Black women's podcasts or TV shows to get validation. Like I'm thinking of Red Table Talk and that Olivia Jade segment and where she was called in and it was like, are you here just because you'll feel better if you have Black women's validation? And I was just like sitting there and I was like, yeah, that makes so much sense. And she probably didn't understand it in that moment. So it's like, it's more productive for me to use what I know to help other white people who followed me, as opposed to just being like, yeah, being hard on people or speaking from an identity that's not my own.
Yeah. Yeah, you're not the Lorax. You don't speak for the trees.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for chatting with me. This was a lot of fun. Yeah, thank you so much for being here.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Fresh from the Hill. Music for Fresh from the Hill was created by Kia Albertson Rogers, class of 2013. You can contact him at koa3@cornell.edu. For more information about Cornell Young Alumni programs and how to stay involved, please visit alumni.cornell.edu/youngalumni or visit our Facebook page at Cornell Young Alumni Programs.